Well, Benny, I know that that you came to New York City with the Four Tops way back when. I don't remember the exact year.
Actually, 1962. I was 21 years old.
How did you move from the R&B of the Four Tops into the world of jazz?
Well, coming from Detroit, I grew up in an environment where there was blues, there was gospel, there was definitely the R&B that so many people are familiar with as a result of Motown. And, of course, there was a strong jazz environment where a lot of musicians were there, Yusuf Lateef, Barry Harris, Alice Coltrane, Donald Byrd, you know, Paul Chambers, all these great people came from Detroit. So being a saxophonist and being in that environment, automatically I was drawn to all of that music. And so it's always been great for me to just be involved in many different things. And my background is that kind of background. So when the opportunity for the Four Tops came up to go out and play with their vocal group and be involved with a trio and myself as a soloist playing supper clubs on the East Coast, came up at a great time for me. I just finished the semester at the Detroit Institute of Musical Art, and I did what you have to do. I quit my day job, and I went on the road, and they ended up in New York City. And it was there that I got to actually go and see and hear Thelonious Monk and his famous quartet with Charlie Rouse, and I think it was Danny Richmond on the drums, and who's a bass player, a guy named John Orr. And that night, my life changed that night. As I sat there and I listened to that music, I realized that if I were ever going to do anything in the music that I love so much, that I would have to be in New York. And that was it. That was the major transition. I guess you could call it an epiphany. People use that word to describe something that just changes everything. And that happened. So I went back with the Four Tops after a couple of days. We had a few days off in New York, and they already had friends there because they had played there many times and worked at the Apollo. And so after it was over and it was time for us to go on, and I think we went somewhere like Atlantic City to play at some of the supper clubs over there, they were asking me, well, how do you like New York, man? What do you think? I said, I love New York. In fact, I went to hear Thelonious Monk, and they were like, they knew who Monk was. And they said, yeah, you did? I said, I love New York so much, I'm going to live here. So right now, I'm giving you my 2 weeks' notice. And I gave them 2 weeks' notice, and after that 2 weeks, they gave me my check, and they all wished me well. And, you know, they were a great group of guys. You know, I owe them a tremendous debt of gratitude because they brought me to New York.
And so after the Four Tops, you moved to New York, you stayed in New York, and yeah. Then how did you break into the jazz scene?
Well, I got there, I stayed there for 1 week, I was flat broke. So I immediately went to the New York State Employment Office and I got a job working in a hospital. And I kept that job for 3 years. And during that time, I was able to meet my peers. I met Marion Brown, I met Beryl Sanders. Later on, I got to meet people like Chick Corea, Jack DeJohnette showed up. So that was a community of musicians going on that was really very healthy at that time. And last week, one of the really great musicians who had a tremendous impact on what was happening in the 60s, he passed away. That was the great Jackie McLean. And Jackie McLean was one of my neighbors. Jackie McLean came to my apartment more than once and jammed with me because I would have little jam sessions in my apartment. He'd just walk across the street and come up, and he was totally inspirational. He was wonderful to be with. And there was such a great closeness in the community. We all shared ideas, and, you know, eventually the work started coming. But, of course, you have guys on a lot of different levels in New York. And, of course, the guys like Miles and Donald Byrd and all the other guys who were around, John Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, they played the really big places. But on the Lower East Side in the East Village, we had our places. We had our loft parties, and we did our little gigs in the little coffee shops and stuff like that. So there was a lot going on there. But because of my foundation from Detroit, I was able to play standard songs. And I played up in Harlem sometimes with the trios, playing blues all night and, you know, tunes of the day and cover tunes and things like that. I worked all the time. I might be up in Harlem on Friday night playing a gig at a place called Count Basie's or Wells or any of those places up there. And then on Saturday night, I'd be down in the village jamming in a loft with Marion Brown and, you know, Don Cherry or somebody. It's like, you know, it was just the flow of things that enabled me to find my way. Because I knew standard language, I studied theory and harmony and these things. And a lot of guys during that time, they didn't have quite the foundation that's necessary to have a career. I didn't think much about having a career. I just wanted to play well. And the idea of having a career didn't really come clear to me until a few years later.
Was Bitches Brew with Miles Davis kind of a pivot point?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Prior to that, I had done recordings, of course, with Horace, and I had done a few other things. A really important recording I did with Kenny Barron and Jimmy Owens, known as You Had Better Listen. It found its way to the radio, and that gave me a presence in New York that made a lot of people pay attention to me because the recordings were played every day. That was when radio was more friendly towards music. Now it's a different day. But I was on the radio every day, and people were saying my name, and they're playing. I said, man, wow, you did this, and you did that. And so the perception of myself as an artist changed. And then I started getting more calls. And then, of course, when I did the recording with Miles, that changed everything.
Is that where you met Herbie, or did you know him earlier?
No, I met Herbie before that. Sonny Rollins is also one of my mentors. I have multiple mentors who have really groomed me and have really opened up the doors, so to speak, so that I could come through. And I met Sonny Rollins in Detroit, just like John Coltrane, when I was like 17, 18 years old. And they both had a hand in really helping me to develop and encouraging me to continue with what I was doing. And so I knew Sonny, of course, and so I contacted him, and I knew he was going to be playing at the Half Note. And I called him and said, Sonny, I really want to come and hear you. And he said, sure. He said, why don't you just meet me there? And so it was kind of interesting because I lived on the Lower East Side. I could just walk across town to where the club was. So I walk across town, and I'm walking towards the club, and I see Sonny coming from down the street. I know it's him. I also know what Herbie Hancock's look like because I've seen him with Miles Davis. But I don't know Herbie. And they're both, I'm standing there in front of the club, and they're both kind of walking towards me. And then we all end up right there in front of the Half Note. And, you know, Sonny says, hey, how you doing? He said, do you know Herbie? So it was Sonny who introduced me to Herbie. And then later, when Herbie left Miles and started his own band with Joe Henderson and Buster and Tootie and the different things that was going on, Joe Henderson left, and Buster said, well, you should call Benny. Because by that time, I'd been working with McCoy Tyner. I'd also been working with Kenny Durham and Cedar Walton. I had done those recordings with Lee Morgan, Caramba. And a lot of things had happened. And my reputation was growing. And so that call from Herbie to come and to be a part of his sextet was really important to me.
Was that the Mwandishi band?
Yes. It was just the Herbie Hancock sextet. And that was actually, there was like some interim members there. At first it was Johnny Coles playing trumpet, but Johnny Coles left. Garnett Brown remained. Joe Henderson was already doing his own recordings for Blue Note. So he wanted, of course, to pursue his own career. I mean, he was ready, you know. And so I replaced Joe, basically. And Woody Shaw replaced Johnny Coles. So for a period there, it was Garnett Brown and myself and Woody Shaw. And we did a few isolated gigs. And then Tootie left, and Billy Hart came. And there was this whole reconfiguration. And Julian Priester came with the trombone because Garnett left. And then Eddie Henderson came, and Buster was there. And then that was the sextet. And then we were the band that recorded in Mwandishi.
And then, of course, Headhunters.
Yeah, that was after the Mwandishi group, of course. The Mwandishi group lasted for approximately 2 years, maybe a little bit more. And then we disbanded, and I was the only member from that group to remain with Herbie. And And we recorded Headhunters.
And is that when you moved to Los Angeles?
Actually, I moved to Los Angeles before that. Yeah, I moved to Los Angeles during my days with the Sextet. Yeah, in the early 70s, 1972. So I basically stayed in New York from 1962 to 1972. Then I moved here.
And Headhunters brought a completely new level, correct?
It certainly did. It changed everything. You know, for us as musicians, has had a tremendous impact and continues to have on young musicians who are discovering it. And we drew a lot of criticism from people who were seriously concerned about the music that we were playing, but we enjoyed every second of it, and it was a phenomenal learning experience. It enabled me to travel all over the world. Everywhere I go these days, people come and they bring that recording and they want my autograph on it, and I very gladly respond by, sure, I'll sign it, no problem, because it did have a tremendous impact.